Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're online all the darn time at NPR.org. So maybe you got up this morning, you got a cup of coffee, checked your favorite news sites online, passed that stuff on to your friends and loved ones, all that best stuff. Well, we were watching you, and we know the stories that you like the best, or should I say, the most.
This
is
what
so
happens when
creepy,
you leave me.
Rachel. Rachel is watching you, America.
Oh, Ian, what you got going on this morning?
All right, this was a most popular in the Capital Times of Wisconsin. A man was charged with deer shining and bail jumping. And I clicked on this because I had no idea what deer shining is.
I don't either.
Deer shining is when you shine your light on a deer to make it freeze in the headlights, as they do. And it's legal most places if you want to do it just to look at deer or to photograph deer or even to scout where deer find food so that you can later come and kill them. But you can't shine on them, freeze them, and shoot them. Or, as is the case in this story, you can't shine your headlights on them and then run them over and take them home. So this guy did that. He shined his lights on a deer. Apparently, this was a really impressive buck. One Department of Natural Resources warden called it, it would be considered by many hunters, the buck of a lifetime. So this guy allegedly sees the deer. As soon as he sees it, he gets really excited about this big buck, runs it over. It sort of hobbles off into the woods. He comes back later with his friends to find it, and it's dead. They put an archer tag on it, as if they had shot it with a bow and arrow, took it home. His friend then, after they gutted it out, his friend then shot an arrow through the buck's dead body so that they would fool the DNR into thinking that...
So they're cheating, basically. They're not.
Yes.
They're hunting with their cars.
Yes, they are.
That's
and
not very nice.
I will say, the man who allegedly did this is from Deerfield, Wisconsin.
Stop it.
It's true. I would also like to say, I have no idea why deer freeze in the headlights. I was trying to find that out. I don't know... Do you guys know what makes them just stand there?
Wouldn't you if a car were coming at you?
Hey, this
no,
is your,
I would get
this
out
is your
of the
editor
way.
And country
hey,
girl,
editor.
Trisha McKinney. I don't know why they do it either, but I just want to say there are a lot of deer in my parents' house. So when I drive to their house at night, I like to cut the lights before I swing into their driveway and then turn on the lights and I pin like 8 deer in the headlights. And it's really amusing.
Are we? Should we laugh at that?
Everyone on this show
I don't
is
run them over.
Out today.
I don't run them over with my car. Everybody. It's just fun.
Okay.
Your
thanks
inbox.
For that story, Ian.
You're welcome.
Wow. Caitlin.
Okay.
Just something less macabre.
I do. I have some good news for the caffeine drinking world out there, which is definitely us.
That would be me. I think I've really had my fill today.
You and also Dan Pashman, who earlier mentioned he's definitely had too much coffee.
I OD'd in the old caffeine earlier.
But there's good news. According to the BBC's most emailed list, daily caffeine protects your brain. Coffee may cut the risk of dementia by blocking the damage cholesterol can inflict on the body. So basically the way it works, there's a barrier between the brain and the main blood supply. And this is the filter that protects the central nervous system from potentially harmful chemicals carried by the rest of the bloodstream. So they did this study at the University of North Dakota, and they gave rabbits an equivalent amount of caffeine. Not coffee, but an equivalent amount. And after 12 weeks of a high cholesterol diet, the blood-brain barrier in those given the caffeine was far more intact in those not given caffeine. Hmm. So it protects you. It keeps it intact. And also, there's been research in the past that said that drinking coffee daily lowers your chance of Alzheimer's. And high levels of cholesterol are thought to be connected to that. So this sort of might explain why they had the previous data.
I would have thought that was good news until this morning when I really do think I OD'd and got kind of
Well,
crazy.
I think it was all the blood rushing through your brain. I think
Yeah, your blood-brain barrier is just so strong.
I think if I can just parse all that scientific mumbo-jumbo, Caitlin, what you're saying is that the more coffee you drink, the more awesome you are.
Yes,
all
exactly.
Right,
that's
cool.
The headline.
Yeah.
You're speaking, so continue.
All right. Hey, guys, I got a most emailed here from Yahoo News. Fifth grader finds mistake at Smithsonian. 11-year-old boy named Kenton Stufflebeam, who all right, is already awesome because that's an awesome name. He went with his family during winter break to the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History in Washington. The Tower of Time exhibit, which displays basically since the dawn of time as we know it until today. It opened in 1981. Millions of people have walked by this thing since 1981, and no one has pointed out that it denotes on the Tower of Time that it's in bold lettering, it says the Precambrian era. It identifies the Precambrian as an era. But Kenton Stufflebeam knew that was wrong. His fifth grade teacher, Mr. Chapman, told him that the Precambrian is not an era. And they filled out a comment card, dropped it in the suggestion box with his dad at the Smithsonian, and they got a letter acknowledging that it was a mistake. And the letter said, the Precambrian is a dimensionless unit of time, which embraces all the time between the origin of Earth and the beginning of the Cambrian.
Unbelievable.
Period. Now, what I found especially funny is that, so first of all, to fix it, they just painted over the word era. So problem
that
solved.
That works.
But apparently the folks in the paleobiology department of the museum have been quietly chafing about this error for the last 27 years.
Oh,
and it took a fifth grader to get them to paint over
Snit
the word.
Or whatever his name is.
Stufflebeam.
Stufflebeam, yes.
Okay. Are they going to offer him an internship?
They ought to.
That's a great
story.
Out
of the mouths of babes.
Not smarter than a fifth grader.
Indeed. Okay, my most is from the BBC Most Read. There's a big, if you've seen Vanity Fair this month, Madonna yes. looking hot to trot. And there's a big article, a big interview with Madge, and she admits to sleeping with, yes, her husband, Guy Ritchie, but also she sleeps with her BlackBerry. She hides it under her, well, she didn't hide it, but she keeps it under her pillow, and apparently Guy Ritchie does too. They're both overachieving, you know, A-type people who have very busy careers. And she says, you know,
So if it vibrates or rings while she's sleeping, does she wake up and start checking her email?
Well, it said that she has it under her pillow for ideas, in case she has an idea.
She wakes up in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Like an electronic notepad?
She has you want to write it down or, you know, do some work, write a song or two. I don't know. But I was mentioning to you guys this morning in the meeting, I read that article, and she just sounds way too not fun anymore. I mean, she doesn't eat anything interesting. Macrobiotic diet, like, you know, 3 hours of yoga, Ashtanga yoga
B12
a day.
B12 shots left and right.
Yeah, B12.
Yeah, anyway. Well, if that's how she's getting her, I mean, I've heard some of the new
albums. She
looks
amazing. She's 49, almost 50, yeah. And she looks great, so.
If that's how she's getting her ideas onto paper through this BlackBerry, maybe she should take a little more time before jotting them down to paper, because some of the new album doesn't sound so great to me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to go there, sorry.
Matt Martinez, you wrapping up the most?
I am. You know, I usually prep all of my segments, and I was not able to do that today because of various I was busy, so Dan Pashman prepped my segment today. I'm just going to read what he wrote, okay?
Okay. Now you know how I feel.
What do moving to a new house and opening CDs have in common? Well, they both involve peeling tape. Whether it's packing tape or that annoying CD seal, you're going to be peeling, and chances are the tape is going to split and get narrow and narrow, and you'll end up with one of those useless strings of tape, and you'll shake your fist at the heavens and cry, "Why has 3M Corporation forsaken me?" This leads us to one of the most emailed stories on NPR.org. It's some mathematicians at MIT trying to find out why tape splits in the first place. NPR's Christopher Joyce did the story.
Pedro Rice is from Portugal, and he traveled a lot before joining the faculty at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. He knows a lot about unpeeling rolls of packing tape.
One of the nightmare situations that I'm starting to dread more and more is each time I have to move. Okay, so is this that sound of the scotch tape unpeeling from the roll?
Rice relives this nightmare by giving a little demonstration in the studio. He works some tape up with his fingernail. The strip starts peeling okay, but soon a tear, or as he calls it, a crack tip, starts on one edge. As he pulls, the tear creeps inward and the strip of tape narrows.
I'm having trouble here myself. I'm peeling a little bit with my nail. Exactly what we studied is happening now. I can't get the full piece.
Perhaps not a nightmare, but annoying.
So now I ended up with a nice triangular, useless piece of scotch tape on my finger, and I have to start over again.
Now, if you've peeled a grape, or a tomato, or removed wallpaper, or tried to get that darned sticky tape off the edge of a new CD, you know about this peeling problem. It just won't come off in nice, even strips. But now, an MIT mathematician can tell you why.
Sine theta is equal to the square root of b tau over 2 eta gamma.
Yes, you heard it right. Sine theta is equal to the square root of b tau over eta gamma. What that equation means is that three things determine when and how the tape will tear. How tough the tape is to bend, how firmly it's stuck onto an object, and how much energy it takes to rip it. Rice says knowing this actually could help engineers test thin films for strength and reliability. As for the rest of us, he says,
go slow. That's my advice.
And if you want to double-check that equation, you can find it in this week's issue of the journal Nature Materials. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
I managed to get the... Oh, no. Okay, I'm sorry about this. I'm making a mess. Crazy over there.